This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 231, was recorded on August 6, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco has arguably been the most prescient voice in the world of finance with regard to predicting the COVID-19 crisis. Yet the rumor on the street is that notwithstanding the worsening new case counts, Jim has turned bullish on the stock market. Jim returns as this week's feature interview guest, and we'll start with this apparent contradiction before moving on to fixed income markets, the U.S. dollar, gold, inflation, digital reserve currencies, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick has prepared yet another of his famous post-game chart books.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 has just not let up. A slow crawl every single day, just a little bit higher. I'm looking forward to putting up a chart on it in the post game. But what's your thinking here on the S&P?
You know, Patrick, we're less than 100 points away from a new all-time high again. And I don't really see the fundamentals in place that would justify a double top pattern in the chart. I think we're climbing up toward a retest of the previous highs. I think that in many ways, it appears that although Alscorus is right during the time we've been off, my predictions have been confirmed that the COVID-19 crisis would get worse before it got better. Well, the thing is, it did get worse, but it seems like we're peaking out on that second wave. Actually, there's an argument to say it's not really a second wave, but a different geographical occurrence or a different location of the first wave occurring in different parts of the country. Regardless of how you want to slice that one, the second peak in new cases seems to have peaked out. So we're probably past the worst of it for this wave. And I think that as that's confirmed and the death rate, which is still trending up, starts to roll over and flatten out or turn downward, I wouldn't be surprised if that takes us to new all-time highs. I don't think that a strong economy is driving this move higher. I think it mostly has to do with central bank accommodation. But it is what it is and looks to me like we're still going to keep on heading higher here. We'll see what happens. In any case, Patrick, Jim Bianco was the one guy who's consistently been two steps ahead of me on this COVID-19 crisis, and he's turned bullish on the stock market. So we'll get to that as my first question in the feature interview.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index, because the last time me and you chatted about the dollar index, we were all the way up at the 96 handle asking the question of whether that support line could hold. And really, in the last couple of weeks, we gave out everything and we're trading down around the 93 handle on the downside with a very distinct downtrend. How do you interpret all of this? What's going on in the dollar?
Whoa, baby. To be sure, it's time to sit up and pay attention to the dollar here. And, you know, a number of key support levels that we've talked about in previous shows have all been broken to the downside. So the question now is, okay, what's going on? Is this just a reaction to the accommodation by the Fed and the money printing and so forth that is seen as weak for the dollar? Or is it bigger than that? Could we be seeing, you know, what I'll call a Grohman level event? I've said for many years now that Luke Grohman's view that the U.S. dollar would eventually lose its reserve currency status and dramatically devalue against other currencies. I've always said Luke would be proven right someday, but I just thought he was several years early. Could it be that it's time for Luke Grohman to be proven right? I'm not sure, to tell you the truth, but I'm going to start asking our feature interview guests, starting with Jim Bianco today.
All right, Eric, let's talk crude oil. I mean, we've been more or less trade range bound, but over the last couple of days, oil's been trying to break out above those highs around that $42 level. What's your take on crude?
Well, yes and no. I think we might disagree on that a little bit, although we may be headed in that direction. We've been consolidating sideways here for coming up on 2 months now, and it looked just a few days ago like maybe, again, we were finally starting to see the market roll over to the downside. Then Beirut blew up. And if you haven't seen the pictures, don't expect to go online and find a picture of the damage done to the seaport in Beirut. What you'll see is a picture of the crater where the seaport in Beirut used to be. And it's really, really big. They're saying this is one-fifth of the size of the Hiroshima nuclear explosion. It's I think, the biggest non-nuclear man-made explosion in history or something. And it was all a result, apparently, of a mistake. But, of course, when anything in that part of the world blows up in a massive explosion, the first thought is, oh boy, are we headed toward, you know, terrorism, maybe something that could be a major upset for the oil market. And as the news started to come out that, well, maybe it was actually just a really negligent mistake of storing a bunch of very volatile chemicals in the wrong place, the very next day, we had the market in the United Arab Emirates blow up. And everybody's wondering, okay, what the heck is going on here? So it's really, I think, ruffled the feathers of the oil market and sent us to some panic upside. It looked to me like this afternoon, particularly into the close, that panic upside is coming back off as we've realized that both of these events were not apparently terrorism or new wars or anything, where they were just dumb mistakes that happened. But let's zoom out, Patrick, to the really big picture. When we had Art Berman on the program, what we discussed is at that point, we were just coming through $40. Art and I both expected the rally to top out around $41 or $42, which it did. We expected it to roll over and move back to the downside. But Art was very quick to say, look, it's a temporary reprieve because we're going to have a bunch of drilled but uncompleted wells that get completed and so forth. That's going to sustain U.S. production levels. And that's exactly what we've seen in the data, is we're sustaining about 11 million barrels a day of U.S. production very consistently in the last several reports. Art said, wait in Q4 for that number to just fall off a cliff and for prices to move higher. Well, we're kind of running out of time. You know, if we thought there was going to be a big downdraft before eventually, you know, the down comes in Q3 and the up comes in Q4, well, we're already halfway through Q3 and we haven't seen any significant downside. So if it's going to happen, it needs to happen pretty soon. Now, the counter argument would be August is usually, from a seasonality perspective, when oil prices top out. But that seasonality is driven by a normal summer driving season, which we don't have this year. So I'm not sure if those seasonality factors really come into play. What I do feel more confident with is Art Berman's going to be right sooner or later. By the end of the year, I think it's very likely that we'll be looking at higher oil prices as a result of U.S. production declining. So do we get any meaningful downside between now and then? I'm still leaving open that possibility, but it's looking less and less like it. Eventually, we're going to get much higher prices once U.S. production declines. Moving on to inventory, well, maybe U.S. production declining is being signaled here because crude oil drawing down 7.4 million barrels, even though we are still showing a U.S. production report of 11 million barrels, which is pretty much stable. The builds on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve have fallen to zero now. So it seems like the effort to move oil out of Cushing into the SPR seems to have been curtailed. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 532,000 barrels, just over a half million barrels. Gasoline, building 419,000 barrels. Distillates, building 1.6 million barrels. And again, U.S. production holding steady. Actually, it's down 100,000 to 11.0 million, but it was up 100,000 last week. So, you know, we're hanging in right here around 11 million barrels. The thing to watch for, and Art Berman says it's coming in Q4, is for that 11 million to fall precipitously through 10 million and we get to a 9 point something. That's where you can look for oil prices to really start to move up. Obviously, the situation in China is very tense with everything going on with the coronavirus crisis and the U.S. administration and so forth. And those China oil buying dynamics are going to be very important. So how goes China's economy is definitely going to have a significant impact. For now, I'm still sort of waiting this out, thinking maybe there's a chance for some more downside, probably not quite as much as Art and I predicted. If we got to low 30s or even $30 a barrel, I think it's time to start buying in anticipation of higher prices in Q4. Maybe we never even get the dip and we just continue to consolidate sideways before eventually resolving higher. So far, what we saw in the last couple of days looks like it was a false alarm, but there's still room to see what happens. So we'll keep a close eye on it.
All right, Eric. Well, I was looking forward to this. Let's talk gold. I mean, when we were last chatting, it was near 1800, and we were asking that question of whether it was going to break out. Well, I mean, that's definitely a breakout. What's your take on how gold has developed over the last couple of weeks?
Well, actually, Patrick, last time we spoke, it had already broken out to 1800, and it had closed above 1800. And you and I were both confused, saying, boy, really thought that a daily close over 1800 would be the signal that would really ignite a rally that would have some gusto to it. And we went for more than a week with really nothing happening, no real downside, no real upside. We were both scratching our heads saying, what the heck? I guess it was just coiling up and getting ready because, boy, as soon as we took our summer break, off it went. We're now up 15% from that $1,800 close that we were discussing last time you and I spoke on the program. So clearly, the move is on. And, you know, we're over $2,000 now. So not only did we get to the previous all-time high of $1,923 per ounce on an intraday basis, I think it was $1,889 or so on a closing basis and $1,923 on an intraday basis. We took those out very quickly. Now we're above $2,000. So we really need to talk quite a bit about gold in upcoming shows. And boy, talk about gold. Look at silver. That's just really taken off like a rocket ship. I'll tell you what, let's come back to this, get into some silver charts and some more detail in the postgame segment when we have more time. And certainly in coming weeks, we need to talk about cup and handle versus no cup and handle. Looks like we're skipping the handle on this one, going straight up. How long can it last? Let's come back to this in postgame.
All right. Well, let's wrap up by touching on the 10-year treasury yield, which continues to just slowly crawl lower. I mean, we almost hit 50 basis points at one point here. What's your take on interest rates?
Well, I'm still looking really at the long term primarily. I don't have any short term view other than it appears that you've been proven right. I'm sure your big picture trading members must be doing well trading U.S. Treasury futures and so forth. As far as the macro picture, though, I want to ask Jim Bianco about this because you've really got to believe in negative interest rates for the U.S. 10-year as a real possibility in order to get very excited about this bull market going much farther. So does it reverse? Do we get a backing up in yields in the next year or two as inflation starts to hit the stage? Or is that still a few years away? That's the question on my mind. I don't know the answer. I'm going to ask Jim Bianco. He's smarter than me when it comes to this stuff.
Okay, we have a quick housekeeping note, folks. Our feature interview transcripts have been delayed due to an illness from our production team. Bear with us. We're working on getting caught up on the transcripts and look forward to returning to our usual policy of having the transcripts up on the website within 48 hours after the show airs. Now, this week's feature interview guest is Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco. Now, Eric, why did we get Jim back on the show this week?
Well, first of all, Jim is the one guy in finance that's been several steps ahead of me throughout this COVID-19 crisis. We're at a really, really important inflection point in the market here. As predicted here on Macro Voices, we have had a second wave of infections, if you want to think of it that way, or a occurrence of a wave of infections in a different part of the country that creates the appearance of a second wave on the chart, if you want to think of it that way. By the way, check your research roundup email. You'll find an excellent video from Dr. Chris Martinson linked, which provides more context on what's going on with COVID-19. But in terms of finance guys that have been on top of this, Jim has been just leading the pack. We're at a turning point, I think, where we may be getting to the worst is behind us, at least for this first major wave of the COVID-19 crisis. So what does that mean? And of course, the other thing is Jim has turned bullish on the stock market, getting a lot of people caught off guard and by surprise. So we want to get some perspective on what brought that about. Folks, before we go to the feature interview, please be sure to write and review us on iTunes. Makes a huge difference in terms of getting us back to where we used to be as the best investment podcast on the internet. Detailed instructions for exactly how to leave a review on iTunes are in your research roundup email. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Jim Bianco is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Bianco Research founder Jim Bianco. Jim, the big rumor on the street is, hey, have you heard Bianco turned bullish on stocks? I want to really ask you what's going on here, because I'm reminded of interviewing Jeff Snyder once, and I described Jeff as being bullish on the dollar. And he interrupted me and said, wait a minute, stop. Bullish means you believe in something. You really believe in the fundamentals. Please don't call me bullish on the dollar. I think the dollar system is broken. I think it's broken badly. It just happens to be broken in a way where a shortage of dollars will cause dollars to appreciate against other currencies. But it's not bullish. It's broken in a way that makes it go up. So what's behind this rumor of Jim Bianco turned bullish? Are you bullish and believing in stocks, or do you think the market's broken in a way that makes prices go up?
I think it's more of the latter, that the market is somewhat, you know, I don't know if I'd call it broken, but it was around late May into the middle of June, I started talking about all of the money printing that the central bank was doing. Initially, I thought, okay, this will give you a Pavlovian response that they're doing money printing and that the markets would go up. And they did, you know, through April and May, but then they didn't stop. And I started looking at the extent of the money printing, and I said, this is going to be a more powerful force than we think it's going to be, and that is going to drive markets higher. And so, just like Schneider would argue, I would say, yeah, I think markets are going up because of the money printing, but I am not arguing here comes the economy back, here comes earnings back, let's break out into a course of God bless America, everything is great. No, I think there are a lot of problems. Or to say the same thing, there is the economy and the fundamentals, and then there is the markets. And let's not confuse the two. And right now, I do think it is not only money printing, because I don't want to stick it all on the central bank, but I also think that it's also got another factor in there too. And that is that you've got the federal government promising, when Trump is tweeting out, we're going to bail out our airlines and we're going to bail out our cruise ships and everybody's going to get money and stimulus checks. And I'll do it by executive order if I have to. I understand why the markets are going higher. And I suspect that until something changes, that's what they're going to continue to do.
Jim, I've gotten a lot of credit in the world of finance for being one of the earliest people on the coronavirus crisis to see what was coming. There's only a few people that were earlier than me, and you're one of them. You and Dr. Chris Martinson come to mind. Give us an update. What are you seeing now? You've been watching this thing since before I was in January. Your charts and graphs have been the best in the industry in terms of tracking what's going on. What do you see? What conclusions do you draw? How do we interpret where we stand now in the story of the global coronavirus pandemic?
Well, a couple of things. It appears, I'll say it this way, it appears that the virus is an indoor virus. Wherever you get people that congregate indoors seems to be where you get some kind of a case count rise. So in February, March, April, that was in the Northern Hemisphere when it was cold outside and everybody was inside. When you get into May, June, July, that is in the Southern Hemisphere where it's unbelievably hot outside and everybody goes and seeks the shelter of air conditioning. And so that's been where you've seen the rise in cases. Now, lately, it seems like we might be having a peak in the case count in the United States. It looks like it peaked about 10 days to 2 weeks ago. The one exception to that might be the upper Midwest, where I'm located in Chicago, right in the middle of it. There seems to be a rise in cases there, but it's at from a low level. but there's a bigger drop in cases in places like Florida, Arizona, California, and Texas as well, too. Away from the United States, the two countries that seem to be most problematic are Mexico, which might have also been promoting the case counts in Texas as well, too, and India. In fact, India is getting set to pass the United States. Since early June, the United States has led in the number of at least reported cases every day. But we're just a few thousand away from India overtaking the United States to become the country that is getting the largest number of cases on a daily basis. So they continue to be there too. South Africa is another country as well. So it looks like we're possibly worldwide peaking at around the 250,000 case level a day as well too. And on the good news front, while there's been an uptick in the number of deaths, both worldwide and in the U.S., we've been well over 1,000, about 1,200 a day right now is what we've been averaging. It is a lot smaller in terms of the number of confirmed cases to deaths, even on a lagged basis, than we saw back in the spring. And that's probably due to better medical techniques, better understanding of the virus from where we were in March, and also a lower age that is getting the virus now. It's no longer people in their 70s or 80s. It's a lot of people in their 40s and 50s that don't have the comorbidities and that they are able to fight it off. But that I said, let me give one warning here or one caveat. A lot of people think that the only statistic that matters is deaths. Okay, people got sick and so less people are dying. So that's good. And that is good. But this is a disease you definitely don't want to get because while there's not been formal studies, there's been a lot of informal studies showing that people that get this disease, they can take months to get over this and they could just be in a brain fog for weeks on end and be sick and just have all kind of problems. This is not the flu. You get it, you feel like crap for a week, you get over it, you move on with your life. You get this, you feel like crap for a week, and it takes a lot of people 2 or 3 months before they start to really feel normal. So let's not discount that this is not a serious disease. It very much is.
Jim, one of the other people that has been really prescient on this is our mutual friend, Dr. Chris Martinson. Now, to my surprise, Chris seemingly kind of changed his tune, or maybe it would be more accurate to say the best analysts change their view when the data changes, and Chris is changing his view. He has a video that was published just Tuesday of this week, August 4th. The title of that one is Lockdowns Doing More Harm Than Good, and we've got it linked in your Research Roundup email. Jim, what Dr. Martinson is saying here is he's saying, look, everybody's got this perception that the U.S. is going through its second wave of coronavirus. And what he's saying is when you really dig into the data, that's not true. What happened was the New York City tri-state area had its first wave a few months ago, and it peaked and it came down and it stayed down. There has been no resurgence in that area. What happened, according to Dr. Martinson, is there are other very high population density areas of the United States, like California, Texas, and Florida, which really hadn't yet had their first wave, and they have just had their first wave. But the point is, the way he's evaluating this data is really there's one really big wave of COVID-19 coronavirus crisis that needs to happen in any geographical area. Once it's happened, it seems like it's kind of done in that area. And there, as much as people thought there would be a second wave, he's saying we're not really seeing those second waves. What we're seeing is the first wave happening in different sub-geographies of the same country, in this case, the United States. Now, it was very interesting to watch his video because he's saying what he thinks it means for the United States is things are probably better than we thought. But ironically, for countries like Australia that were standing up as the pinnacle of one of the best managed countries in the world, He's saying, wait a minute, they did such a good job with their lockdown, or such an effective job with their lockdown being early, that they prevented the first wave, which might be something that's just inevitable. And they may have done nothing more than to delay something which is still going to happen. So he has some concern for where Australia, previously perceived to be one of the best managed COVID-19 countries, was headed. And he's becoming more optimistic for some of the worst places like the United States and Europe, because he's got a different spin on the data. I know you saw that video. What do you make of it? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Is Dr. Martinson missing anything? Do you see anything differently?
No, I largely agree with it. I mean, you know, what he was arguing in the video is something that I've seen in the data too. If you go into a lockdown and you restrict mobility and you demand that people wear masks and social distance and not congregate in groups, it largely works to hold down the virus spread. But the economic cost and pain is so high to do a lockdown that it almost becomes that the cure is worse than the disease. And the lockdown will only delay but not end. So in a country like Australia, they go into a lockdown. Guess what? They've got no cases. Well, they can't let their economy collapse all the way to zero. So they back off on the lockdown, and then their wave one reappears. It just comes right back as soon as you let off on the lockdown. And I think what he was saying is something that I've been arguing too. This is a serious disease, and we need to take it serious, and we need to wear masks and social distance and do all of the things that wash our hands and do all the things we're supposed to do. But we have to learn to live with it. We have to learn to deal with it. As long as we do not overrun the healthcare system, that was the original intent of lockdowns, was to keep the bed count from going above 100% of available beds, then we just have to learn to deal with this and maybe make appropriate situations for older people and people with comorbidities. But if we're going to go into lockdown and say that that's all we could do, we can never leave it. We can never leave a lockdown unless there is a highly effective vaccine, and there might not be one for months, if not years, if ever, because the latest thing that they're talking about with a vaccine now is it might be only 50% effective. And that might be not enough to actually end a lockdown as well. So I agree with the idea that this is a serious disease, and that once it runs its case, like you see in New York City, or you see in a lot of the Northern European countries, that it's been hard to see another rise in case counts, that we need to weigh that against the damage that we're doing to the economy in terms of lockdowns, and that that damage might be greater than what we're trying to prevent with trying to stop the spread of the disease.
Jim, I want to go a little further on that point and come back to something you said when we were talking about the stock market, which is to distinguish the difference between what's happening in markets and what's happening in the economy. So a mistake that I made, and I think a lot of people made, was when we saw stocks starting to recover, we said, just a bear market rally. You know, we know there's further to go to the downside for stocks here because this is a serious problem. Turns out that the central bank policy reaction is so strong that it seems like stocks really are recovering, and we are seeing a V-shaped stock market recovery. At least so far, that's what we're seeing out of this coronavirus crisis. I think that's leading a lot of people to the assumption that, okay, so that means that the stock market always leads the economy. So the economy is going to recover V-shape from the coronavirus crisis as well. Is that true, or is there a big fallacy there that we need to understand?
Oh, I think there's a big fallacy there. And I think, first of all, let's talk about the economy. The signs are that the economy did recover from the second quarter slowdown, the minus 32.9% annualized GDP. But about mid-June, it seemed to have stalled in terms of its recovery. The initial claims numbers bottomed out and started to creep higher. The mobility numbers, the open table numbers showing restaurant reservations, the home-based numbers showing the amount of activity among small businesses, all kind of stalled. I'm not going to say reverse, but they stalled. They've stalled well below the pre-virus levels. So we never quite made it all the way back in terms of where we were going from there. And in our work, when we look at it, if you break it down by state and you look at the states that are seeing a resurgence of the virus versus the states that are not, it seems like there's a very strong correlation between where the virus is resurging and the states that are seeing more and more slowing of the economy, meaning that while the governors of those states didn't lock them down, people in those regions know what's going on. We see that our case count in my state or my city is going up, and they react in kind. They say, okay, it's getting bad here. I'm going to self-quarantine myself, or I'm going to travel less or do less economic activity. And you see that in the data. When their case counts have stayed low, they've seemed to have risen a little bit more. That's what's happening in the economy. Let's talk about what's happening in the markets. The markets have been recovering because of central bank intervention. And again, I want to also put the federal government in there too, with all of the stimulus that they have been plowing into the markets as well. But there's a fallacy there. And the fallacy is the wealth effect. In fact, Jay Powell said this again in his last press conference last week. If we put a floor in markets and markets recover, that will help the economy recover. What he's saying is they have completely believed in the wealth effect. In other words, let me say this bluntly. No market can ever be overvalued, because if we shove a stock market or a bond market into the stratosphere, they then expect that people will feel wealthy because of that increased wealth, spend more money, be more economically active to justify those higher prices. And that is what is driving the whole idea behind what the Federal Reserve and the government is doing. The way that we're going to increase economic activity is to make you feel wealthier through higher prices. Now, that's backwards. You and I have been taught that the way that it works is we hire a bunch of analysts and they look at the economy, they look at a stock or a security independently and come up with an intrinsic value. Then they compare it to what the financial markets are offering as the price for that security to determine whether or not it represents an overvalued or undervalued situation. In other words, the economy drives the markets. The Fed has turned that around and is saying the markets drive the economy. And that's where I think they're going to get themselves into trouble over the long haul, is that this whole idea that if we push markets enough, we're going to work on it. It's going to work in the short term being several months, which is what we talked about at the beginning, which is why I think markets are going to go higher. But I do fear that is not the way that it usually works. I don't start my day by deciding how much I'm worth by my portfolio and then adjusting my behavior. I start my day by looking at how I'm doing in my career and in my business, and hopefully that is reflected in my portfolio. It works the other way around. And I fear that what we're going to see over time is malinvestment. Malinvestment meaning that we're propping up a bunch of companies that shouldn't be propped up. We're going to see inflation and we're going to see problems on the line. Now, I don't think that's going to be a 2020 problem. I think that's going to be a 2021 problem or maybe a 2022 problem as we move forward from here. So I do worry that, you know, we got to look at what the economy is doing. It stalled in mid-June. There is a V bottom in the stock market. But do not assume that the V bottom in the stock market will immediately translate to a V bottom in the broader economy. Because if you do, then you're arguing that what drives everything is the wealth effect. How wealthy do I feel is how it drives it. Usually it works the other way, not going in that direction.
Jim, it sounds like we are in strong agreement that markets are V-shaped recovering because of central bank policy. The economy is not V-shaped recovering. What concerns me a lot is, you know, as much as you and I agree that it's central bank policy driving this market, frankly, a lot of mainstream finance guys think that's a conspiracy theory, and they believe in what they've been trained in, which is the S&P 500 is a leading economic indicator. If the market is recovering, the reason is because the market is predicting a recovery in the economy. And I would make the argument that what's really going on here is central bank policy is distorting the efficacy of what were previously very reliable leading economic indicators, in this case, the stock market, indicating where the economy is headed. I think that leads, as you say, to malinvestment, a lot of bad decisions. Let's talk about the central bank policy that gets us here. How do we get to this? It feels to me like somehow because of this crisis, all of a sudden, hey, $1 trillion here, $1 trillion there, it's nothing. We'll just, you know, expand the Fed's balance sheet in ways that even in the era of quantitative easing for the last 10 years, the magnitude of change that we're seeing now, when QE2 was introduced, oh my gosh, it was really, really big. Then all of a sudden, in this latest round, we're talking about $650 billion per week at one point that we were going to. So it's a whole new order of magnitude. And it seems like each new round is a new order of magnitude bigger. When does this ever end, and what does it potentially lead to? What's the end game here?
Well, I think the end game is going to be, let me say this, we're on the precipice of a major change in economic thought one way or the other. You know, when you talked about QE being really big, you know, QE2, when it was announced in 2011, was $600 billion. And people were blown away by that size. You're right.
That was for the whole thing, not per week.
Yes. And then in 2020, we were doing that per week. You know, just like I'll give you another statistic. We've talked a lot about the $600 a week that we're giving everybody in unemployment benefits. Do you know what the number was in 2009 that had everybody freaked out? It was $25 a week is what it was in 2009. It's 24 times larger this time around than it was before as well, too. So we're doing everything in bigger moat. And that's because the central bank believes that they had a successful outcome in 2009. They stepped in with all of this massive stimulus and they stimulated us out of a financial crisis, or maybe we were coming out of it anyway because we were 2 years into it. And they believe that it worked and they believe that they could do that again. Now, what I mean by that we're on the precipice of a major economic thought is that one of two things is going to happen. Either, as I've teased before, I think it leads to malinvestment or inflation in the next year or two. And then these policies get repudiated because they've made things worse, or worse yet, they've created massive inequality, which is what they're probably doing in a big way right now. Or when Ben Bernanke testified before Congress last week, he said, there will be no inflation. This will be just fine. And when Jay Powell testifies, he says, we're doing these extraordinary actions, but then when everything calms down, we're going to put these tools back in the toolbox. No, you're not. If you're going to do this, and all you think is going to happen is higher prices, more wealth, a good feeling of everything is fine, more jobs, more GDP, only good things, no bad things like inflation or malinvestment, this is the new world we live in. Let me give you one statistic. The Treasury's general account, the TGA, is the checking account of the federal government. Typically, they keep about a week's worth of operating profits in that account. So that's about $200-300 billion. As of the end of July, it had $1.8 trillion with a T in it because of all of the massive borrowing and the $3 trillion deficit. Yes, we've run a $3 trillion deficit through the year ending in June. The July numbers will be out in about 10 days. And so we've ballooned that account up to $1.8 trillion from an old peak of a $200 or $300 billion. How big is that number? All of the 1040 tax returns in the last year have generated to the Treasury about $1.4 to $1.6 trillion in tax receipts. They are sitting with their Treasury general account with a year's worth of tax receipts in that account. If all good stuff is happening, you can borrow and the central bank can print and buy that paper and you could create out of thin air a whole year's worth of tax receipts without anything bad happening, then great. Let's go full MMT. Let's put Stephanie Kelton in charge of everything. And the first act we're going to do is we're going to eliminate the 1040 form. We don't need it anymore. We've just borrowed a whole year's worth of taxes. And so this is going to be the new way we're going to do stuff. The new way the Fed is going to operate is they're going to be in the permanent market manipulation business, buying ETFs, buying corporate bonds, buying municipal bonds as well, too. That's going to be their job. Under MMT, and I do think MMT's got an argument here, is that they would argue that you can't borrow forever. They kind of get that bad rap, and even Jay Powell kind of tagged that to them, that they say that you can borrow forever. No, they say you can borrow an extraordinarily large amount. But at some point, you create inflation. And their argument is the way you really deal with an inflationary problem is you raise taxes. So in their world, interest rates are low and stable somewhere around zero and never move. The tax rate goes up and down and fluctuates like with the cycle of the economy, the opposite of what we have now. Interest rates go up and down and fluctuate with the cycle of the economy, and tax rates never move. So if we can pull this off, we can borrow trillions of dollars and only good stuff happens, then MMT's won and we should go full MMT. But if it doesn't and it creates malinvestment and inflation, and that's my bet that that's what we'll see, then we're going to have a repudiation of these policies. What I think is going to be the least likely outcome is what Jay Powell said. He says what he plans on doing. I'm going to come in with all these extraordinary tools and I'm going to single-handedly fix everything. And once it's fixed, I'm going to go away. No, you're going to come in with all these tools and you're either going to make it worse and then you're going to go away, or you're going to fix everything. And then that's going to be the new way we're going to operate under an MMT world. You're not going to go away if it's all good, but you'll be asked to go away if it's all bad. And so I think that either way, we're going to wind up with some kind of a major rethinking of economic theory.
Okay, wait a minute, Jim, because the way this is falling on my ears, it sounds awfully polarized. I'm hearing you say there's two choices here, could go either way. Option one is we repudiate the policies which have been very damaging. What it takes to get there is you got to get a significant portion of the broad population to understand the intricacies of why the creation of M0 money supply didn't translate to bank lending that expanded M1 money supply. And all of this central banking theory concept stuff that geeks like you and I think are interesting, but most people would just glaze over. Option two is you sell everybody on the idea that there should be more free stuff and free money for everybody. I got a feeling the second one's going to sell better. Am I missing something there?
No, the second one will sell better, because that's why I said the second one is you created all this free money and free stuff and nothing bad happened. So why are you going to stop? The first one, yeah, you're right. I'm not going to geek out about the velocity of money and all of that other stuff that no one understands. And heck, most economists don't really understand it as well, too. I think the way that the public will understand that will be inflation. It will be that the inflation, which has not been a case for probably 30 years, returns in a big way. And how do I know that inflation will return in a big way? If I'm the public, interest rates will go up and go up a lot. Now, the central bank is a powerful force that they can suppress markets and interest rates. As we pointed out, they were buying $600 billion a week in March of bonds. They have bought $3 trillion of bonds since March, an astounding number that they've bought, and they can suppress interest rates. But there is one group that is larger than them, and that is the collective of the financial markets. Right now, we don't have a collective of financial markets. We've got a lot of different opinions in the markets. Some are bullish, some are bearish, some think spreads are going to widen or tighten in, out, up, down, forward, or backward. So in that environment, when the market is fragmented in its opinion, the central bank rules. But if we get inflation and everybody in the market gets of one mind, here comes inflation, the Fed's policy is creating it, I have to get away from this market because it's a loss of money to own a fixed income asset in a rising inflation environment, and they all start to sell, they can overwhelm the central bank then, and you would see rising interest rates. So how do you get the public to repudiate this? They see inflation, they see higher interest rates. That should translate into lower risk markets, meaning the stock market as well too. That's how you get your repudiation of these policies. But you're right. If you stand at the street corner and start talking about, you know, showing people the charts of the velocity of money and that this is all going to end bad, you know, they're going to want to take you to the loony bin right now. No one wants to hear that. Everything is getting, the stock market is getting better. We're hoping that everything is going to get better right now. It's only when it has turned bad that you will see that repudiation.
Well, let's take that a little bit farther, Jim. What happens, let's suppose that what sells to the guy on the street corner is not the velocity of money chart, but it is rather the list of bullet points of free college tuition, forgiveness of previous student loans. There's going to be increased social benefits for everybody. There's going to be universal basic income that is considered a basic human right. So everybody gets a working wage, whether they're working or not. All of these things are going to be delivered. Stephanie Kelton is going to be in charge of the Fed. And their strategy, as you said earlier, is as soon as inflation starts to run away, what they do is they punitively tax the rich in order to arrest inflation. And those SOBs deserved it anyway. Let's give that some credit. There is some legitimate thinking behind that. The aggressive taxation of the wealthiest taxpayers would have some effect on muting inflation. What's wrong with that strategy? Why shouldn't we let Stephanie Kelton take over the Fed and be in charge of a whole new era of economic policy, which does deliver all of these benefits of socialism and apparently can do it without any adverse consequence? What goes wrong? Why does it go wrong? And how does it go wrong?
Well, it's inflation that makes it go wrong. If the answer is, let's give everybody free stuff, and let's just do what we've been doing. And to some extent, we've already got that experiment working. We're giving $600 a week to everybody who's unemployed. We've been sending $1,200 checks out to everybody who makes less than $100,000 a year. And as I look at the financial markets, I don't see them particularly upset with this policy, meaning that we've got this massive budget deficit in order to finance this. And the bond market and the stock market doesn't seem to be particularly upset. So if that continues to be that the markets aren't upset, they'll continue to send that money out. Now you get inflation, and you're right, all the rich SOBs raise their taxes. Well, what we're assuming here is we're going to raise their taxes for 1 year, drain some money out, hold down the inflation rate, and then it's going to go back down. But if instead we raise their taxes and we have to keep raising their taxes or keep them at a high level to try and hold down inflation, then we're back to the 1940s or 1950s when we had a 91% marginal tax rate at its peak in the late 1940s. It retards investment, it retards growth, it retards business formation, and the public sees, okay, you've given me enough money so that my Netflix account is free, I can order a couple of fun things from Amazon, but I don't have a job. I don't have any purpose. I don't have any opportunity to really move forward from here. This is not enough for me to continue to want to say that this is a good idea. And the rich are going to say, I can't create new businesses in this environment. I can't create investment and opportunities in this environment as well, too. So it really comes down to inflation. If inflation comes back, then your response would have to be that these policies are not working. If Bernanke is right and there will not be inflation, and he was emphatic about that last month, then we're not going to stop doing this. Why should we stop doing? Why should we give everybody free stuff and there's no inflation and there's nothing bad? Why would you stop it? You're not going to. You're going to continue to do it in that regard. So it really comes down to that whole inflation argument. And that's why I said, either way, we're either going to get inflation or something bad from these policies, and that's my bet. But I'm trying to be open-minded to say, look, if I'm wrong on that, and we don't get this inflation and this bad stuff, and it's all good, I don't see why we would say, okay, we're only going to give you free stuff in a pandemic, but now that the pandemic's over, you don't get free stuff anymore. No, you're going to keep giving it to me all the time. That's where we're going to go. So I think that it really is about inflation, and I think if it comes back, it's not going to be, we're just going to jack in taxes on them for 1 year, and that will get rid of the inflation problem. It might be that we're going to have to jack taxes up a lot and leave them there in order to deal with the inflation problem, and that will create a whole host of problems.
And what are those problems, and how does that affect the person who, you know, hey, tax the rich, the hell with them. I'm not the rich. Let them pay the bill. It's about time that they paid their fair share. What can go wrong for the guy on the street as a result of that taxation policy?
What you're giving them is something on the margin. You're giving them UBI, universal basic income, a couple of $100 a week, maybe $1,000 a month if you go full Andrew Yang as well too. And that helps them, like I said, you pay for your Netflix account, you go out to dinner with your family a little bit, put a little bit away in savings as well, and that helps. But what it's assuming is I also have a job. I also have a job and a purpose as well, too, that this on top of that would help. You know, backing off on college tuition costs or making college tuition free, that's great. Once my kids get to 18 years old, that would help as well, too. So all of that helps at the margin, assuming I have a job. But if all of this creates such dislocation in financial markets that it imperils the ability of me to have a job in the first place, then you become a net loser on this. Yeah, they give you $1,000 a week and a couple of other things as well, too. Maybe they'll throw in free internet, you know, to kind of get you all excited. But I would rather have a job than to have free internet $1,000 a week if I had to choose between the two. But what they're trying to promise you now is you can have both a job and all of this extra stuff as well, too. And that is what we're going to have to find out, whether or not that is sustainable. For the moment, it appears to be that it is, because the markets are not rejecting this policy. But I do think that as we move forward from here, I think that it might start to, especially when the calendar turns to 2021.
Before moving on from this topic, I just want to mention, I would love nothing more than to get Dr. Stephanie Kelton on the show to tell her side of this story. We have invited her several times. She hasn't responded to our invitations. I do have a reputation for really allowing my guests to tell their story without interrupting them or arguing with them. If anyone in the audience has Dr. Kelton's ear, please encourage her to accept our invitation and come tell her story on Macro Voices. I would love to interview her and really get into this in detail. Jim, let's move on to your specialty of fixed income markets. Based on this very tentative, you know, the big risk is inflation, but it looks like it's not happening yet. But it could happen. It could happen in a big way, but not yet. How do we translate that to what to expect in terms of bond yields?
Let me start off with the bigger picture. March 9th was an extraordinary day in the bond market. And you saw the 10-year yield hit an intraday low of 31 basis points. You saw the 30-year hit an intraday low of 69 basis points. For those that are not steeped in the bond market right now, we're at 55 basis points in the 10-year, and we're at 1.21% in the 30-year. So we're well off those levels, but they've been trending lower. The Fed has been buying a lot of bonds. They're the largest buyer of bonds. And I think it's just been a mere lack of selling by the public, and that is what's been giving you that downtrend in bonds as well, too. I would argue about two things about the bond market. One, what we talked about earlier, do not think that what's happening in the bond market is a reflection of economic activity or a belief about economic activity. The central bank is so distorting in the bond market right now that, yes, yields are going low because they're buying them, but I'm not ready to make the leap that that means that the economy is doing X or Y or Z. I think it's more about the central bank as well, too. So I could see yields kind of meandering lower, but I don't see them taking out those March 9th lows. I think the 39-year bull market ended on March 9th with those lows. At most, maybe we retest them, but that's about it at this point. I do see that, like we've talked about before, a resurgence of inflation and that the risk is of higher yields, not of negative yields, as we go forward from here. I think that the risk is that interest rates go up once everybody gets their mind around it. And yes, we overwhelm the central bank. When interest rates start up, they will probably announce some version of yield curve control. That's nothing more than price fixing. That is where, you know, take what the Bank of Japan calls yield curve control. They have said that they want to target, I'm talking about the Bank of Japan now, their 10-year yield at zero. And that they will step in and buy as much as necessary to push rates down to zero. If they go below zero, they stop buying to let them drift back up to zero. Our central bank would do something similar when we get into a rising rate environment. But if that comes because of inflation, then I don't think that they alone can stop it if the market is of all one mind. So yields trend lower a little bit, but the next big move is up. Into next year is what I'm thinking about. On the back of inflation is where it comes. And the central bank will try and fight that along the way. But if it comes with higher yields on the back of inflation, I don't think they'll be successful.
Let's talk about the U.S. dollar and what happens to the dollar relative to other currencies in the face of everything that we see coming. For years now, there's been a group of people, I'll say Luke Groman in my mind is probably the best spoken of the bunch, who hold the view that the U.S. dollar's days are numbered as the global reserve currency. And their expectation is that the dollar is eventually going to devalue dramatically against other currencies in the same way that the pound sterling did after it lost its reserve currency status. And they don't see just a little bit of down in the dollar. They see huge down in the dollar. You know, I've always said I fully predict that Luke Groman and others will be proven right in that someday, but there's got to be a viable alternative to the U.S. dollar to serve as the global reserve currency before that can happen. And I've always thought those guys were early. Now we're seeing a pretty darn significant downside momentum event in the U.S. dollar index. Is this that Luke Groman moment where we're seeing the beginning of the end, or is this just a knee jerk and it's still too early for Luke to be proven right?
I'd say it's too early, and I would also lean on that it is not that moment. I think what's happening with the dollar is during the height of the panic in March and in April, you had people viewing the dollar as a safe haven currency, and you had tremendous flows to the dollar. You even had the central bank start dollar swap lines to try and meet that excess demand for the dollar. That is reversing right now, that people are now saying, I don't need to own dollars as a hedge against the end of the world, and that they've been moving out of it. And that's why you've seen the dollar weakness. As far as the dollar losing its reserve currency status, I've been astounded by the number of stories that says, well, the dollar's going down, it's going to lose its reserve currency status. To who? We're going to get out of one fiat currency because the central bank is printing money recklessly called the dollar and go into another fiat currency where the central bank is recklessly printing money called the euro or the yen. You know, if you're talking about, is the dollar going to go down? If you asked, if you drew that larger against all fiats, yes, because that's why you're seeing the price of gold rise and maybe the price of commodity, other general commodities rise. I'm with you there that it's going to go up against those and maybe even against the price of cryptos. But to argue that it's going to swap from one fiat, the dollar, to another fiat, the euro, other than on a tactical basis, because we're unwinding that flight to quality trade, which is what I think we've been doing lately. Yes, that'll happen. But I don't think it's the sign that we're going to move to a new reserve currency. The next reserve currency, I believe, will be a crypto. I don't think that crypto exists right now, but it's not going to be pick among the existing fiat currencies. That's going to be the next reserve currency, either the euro, the yen, the yuan, take your pick. I think they're all equally bad is what basically what I'm trying to say. That's not your fix. So I see this as a cyclical move that's more of an unwind of what we saw in March when we saw that dollar strength. Then I see this as some kind of a terminal move. All of the fiats will go down against cryptos and against like gold, which I heard somebody once described as the natural crypto, which I love that description. I think that those will go up in price, and they have, and I think that they will continue to. But I don't see this as being some kind of a massive shift out of dollars and into euros or yen or British pounds or some other fiat.
Jim, you just touched on a subject that's very much near and dear to my heart because I published a book called Beyond Blockchain back in 2018, predicting that the U.S. dollar would eventually be replaced by a digital global reserve currency. Now, I want to touch on when you say a crypto, exactly what you mean by a crypto, because as I see it, there's three possibilities for what could replace the U.S. dollar as global reserve currency. Could be a first generation cryptocurrency like Bitcoin or Ethereum that was invented by anarchists whose goal was to create an alternative to government issued money. The second possibility would be it could be a government issued digital currency, a central bank digital currency or CBDC as they've come to be called, which I had anticipated in my book. And then a third possibility would be some Silicon Valley billionaire, like certainly we saw the beginnings of this with Mark Zuckerberg's foray into the digital currency world with Facebook's Libra project, which has been shut down at least for now, but you never know, you know, what Google's working on that they haven't told us about. Maybe Silicon Valley comes up with a digital currency, which they've designed for the purpose of replacing the dollar. And it's not designed to appeal to libertarian, you know, Bitcoin enthusiasts. It's more designed to appeal to central bankers who are sick of the dollar's monopoly over reserve currency status. Of those three, or invent your own if there's a fourth one, what kind of digital currency do you think potentially replaces the dollar long-term as the world's reserve currency?
I think it's the third one. I think it's going to be some kind of a Silicon Valley type of operation. You're right. The first one in Bitcoin and in what the anarchists invented is more of a store of value, but it cannot be really a medium of exchange because I don't think we're quite there yet to be able to handle hundreds of thousands of transactions a minute if you wanted to make it a true reserve currency. If we're going to get rid of the dollar, I think it is part that it is repudiation of government running a currency, and that going to another government running a currency is not going to be the answer. So when people talk about that there's going to be a digital yuan or a digital euro or a digital dollar, that's not going to fix anything. That's just changing, taking the same problem and just changing its stripes. The third option you gave me, the Silicon Valley, they're looking at, whether it's in the DeFi area or they're looking in some of these other areas, at some kind of a stable currency, stable coin actually exists, that can be used in massive numbers to as a medium of exchange. And remember that we already have all of the ingredients to make this work. So maybe you've got a Google trying to cook up this thing within their area of expertise. You've got a Facebook that's got 2 billion plus users of Facebook. As the professor, New York University professor Scott Galloway likes to say, remember that there's 2.2 billion Christians on the planet, and there's 2.3 billion people that have a Facebook account. Facebook is more popular than Christianity right now. So if you come up with something that either Facebook comes up with it with their Libra project or Google comes up with it, you've got widespread adoption through Facebook. And then you've got Amazon, which Amazon is what 60% of the American public has an Amazon Prime account. So as soon as you give them something that they could use, if Amazon accepts it as payment, it's immediately got legitimacy to it almost overnight as well too. But that's where I see it coming. Now, are they working on that idea? Yes, I think they are working on that idea. Is it imminent that's going to come out? I don't know if it's imminent that it's going to come out, but it's I think it's a lot closer than we think it could be. Finally, I'll mention one other thing too. When you talk to Americans and you say about a digital currency, whether it's backed by the government or not, as being the new reserve currency, a lot of people roll their eyes and say, "Oh, that's not going to work." But bear in mind that Americans have among the developed world and even parts of the developing world, the lowest percentage of digital payment usage that we've seen anywhere else. In Kenya, they've got a thing called M-Pesa, where these people live in mud huts in little villages, and they all have smartphones. It's the third generation smartphones we gave away 2 years ago. And they all, at night, they're all being hooked up to a Honda generator, charging these 100 phones. They transfer money back and forth to each other through this M-Pesa platform in Kenya. They transfer money back and forth to each other in India. They transfer money back and forth to each other through their phones in Europe in greater numbers than the United States. So we might talk to people and go, "Yeah, but I just pulled this 20 out of my pocket. Why would I need this digital currency?" But the rest of the world's ready for it. You just got to give, you know, we just got to invent the platform. They'll adopt it. And then they'll force us to adopt it much faster. But if we're waiting for a 50-something in the United States to say, "I'm going to stop using those 20s in my wallet for a currency," that's not where it's going to come from. They'll be the last one to adopt it because everybody else will force that on them. So that's where I see the next reserve currency coming. Right now, like I said, I don't think we're there yet, but that's where it's going to come from. I just want to emphasize, I just don't buy this argument that we're all going to basically bail on the dollar for the euro. I don't think that fixes anything. I think you just transfer from one to the other, and you still got the same problems that you had with the dollar. You're just using a different currency, and you haven't really made it much better.
Well, once again, Jim, we are exactly on the same page. When I first wrote my book in 2018, I was leaning a little bit more toward the central bank issue digital currency, a sovereign digital currency replacing the dollar. But the more that I've seen, the more I'm convinced it comes from Silicon Valley. And I'll just add the caution to our many crypto enthusiasts in the audience. Those of you guys who just roll your eyes and laugh off something like Libra, saying it's not decentralized, it doesn't meet the design objectives that are valued by cryptocurrency designers. You've got to understand that they have different design objectives. They're trying to solve a different problem. Never underestimate the ability of a sociopathic child billionaire to screw the world up. And I'm really glad that Libra got shut down. I think that we are not done seeing Silicon Valley invent digital currencies with the ambition of replacing the dollar as the world's global reserve currency. And I think that the problems that that creates in terms of people in Silicon Valley having even more power than they already have over society really need to be taken seriously. Anyway, that's a subject for another podcast. We can't end this one, Jim, without touching on gold.
Higher. I think gold is going to go higher. Gold is largely a way to get your money out of the financial system. Now, it's not a perfect fit. You know, it's still tied up in the financial system somewhat. The big, most popular way to own gold is through an ETF like GLD. And so you're still trapped in the financial system when you do it, but it's the way you get your money out. Now, why do you want to get your money out of the financial system? You fear inflation, you fear deflation, you fear financial crisis, you fear all of the above. Something is not right. That's why you try to get your money out of the financial system. That's why I think gold has been going higher. Lastly, when I look at the measures of speculation, either the commitment of traders report or the flows into ETFs or even the shape of the forward gold futures curve, it's, you know, there's some signs of speculation. It's not absent, but it's also at a new all-time high, but it's not out of hand. So usually I think gold goes because what drives gold more than anything else is demand. People want it or they don't want it. And right now they want it and it's going up and it's making new highs. And when I look at the signs of speculation, I say they're not out of hand right now. So it's going to continue to go higher until such time that it does become out of hand. I don't know if that's in 2 weeks or in 3 years, but right now it seems to be wanting to trend higher. And if you ask me, well, what's the story behind it? An unease that there's some problem somewhere. They can be inflation. They can be deflation. They can be financial crisis. They could be too much money printing. They could be all of the above, but that there is some fear of it. And what do I do when I fear that there's problems? I try and get my money away from those problems, and it's not perfect, but the option you have is gold.
Jim, before we close, let's bring our listeners. I can't believe anybody doesn't know about BiancaResearch.com and also at Bianco Research on Twitter. Tell people what they can expect to find there if they're not already tuned in.
Yeah, so we are an institutional investor service. Our clients are mainly institutional investors around the world that subscribe to us. If you go to our website, BiancaResearch.com, or mainly I would direct you probably to my Twitter feed at Bianco Research or LinkedIn under my name, Jim Bianco. I try to post examples of what we do. There are links that you can request a free trial of our research to kind of get under the hood and see a lot more of what we do. So go ahead and take a look at all of those venues, probably starting with Twitter, which is probably the main venue that I use. And if you like what you see, there's always a link at the top of my Twitter feed that you can request a free trial to see more of what we do in our research.
And I can't recommend it strongly enough. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Jim back on the show and get an update on what his thought process is. Anything that you took away from the interview?
Well, everything, really. I really enjoy talking to Jim. He's one of my favorite guests that we have on the show. And I really am in strong agreement with just about everything that he said. I want to get into more detail on some of those topics, though. So let's get into our post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. It says Big Picture Trading Chart Book. Patrick, let's go ahead and hit it here with page two. We're looking at S&P 500 futures. Why this chart and what are these yellow lines showing us?
Well, all I really just wanted to do was do an update from the last chart book we had, just showing that we were looking at the time at the overhead resistance levels, just above that 3200 level. And the market really has just gone right through that and continues to crawl higher toward the next major resistance level, which is its previous highs. Now, will we see an all-time high? I think a lot of it has to do with where the leadership comes from on the market. I mean, we certainly saw very strong reaction on earnings on a number of these different FANG stocks. And if that creates a tailwind pushing the NASDAQ to all-time highs, it'd be very hard for the S&P not to be dragged higher with all of that as those market cap behemoths finish off some of these bigger moves. But it is the S&P is a very distinct uptrend. And one pattern that we've seen, even when I break it down to more intraday charts, is every dip is so far being bought. And it's a very systematic process higher. And we haven't seen the technical break or the damage that are the warning signs I typically look for a turn. And doesn't mean it can't emerge in the coming weeks. But at least at this moment, the market has been pretty systematically behaving in its upward trajectory.
Now, Patrick, there's a very well-known pattern called a double top in technical analysis. Do you see reason to think that this is about to be a double top and maybe, you know, it's time to sell here? Or is that not really called for with what you're seeing in the charts?
You know, the interesting part is that it's all about, I think, the way that the NASDAQ and those FANG stocks trade, because right now the NASDAQ looks incredibly bullish and those breakouts that we've seen on a number of those stocks like Apple and Amazon really continue to show that the trend may continue. And if that's the case, it's going to be hard for any of these other major U.S. indices not to get some sort of a tailwind from that can push it higher if we still see a little bit more on the upside there. But what is interesting is that we're getting a lot of divergences in a lot of the other developed markets, you know, especially European equities just don't seem to be participating at all. And so really, this continues to be a U.S.-driven rally. And some of the periphery markets like the KOSPI in South Korea continues to get a lot of that tailwind from a lot of the semiconductor kind of stocks that have been working so well in this environment. I mean, there is a chance we're going to see a double top, but at least at this moment, I think the most immediate thing that we want to watch is, are we going to A, approach it, and two, does the NASDAQ break out? I mean, I think those are two very important things to watch that will answer that question.
Let's go ahead and move on to the U.S. dollar index on page three. Boy, look at that support level at 96 that really held so reliably, going back almost 18 months. And all of a sudden, once we took it out, boy, look out below. What's your take, Patrick, on what comes next here? Are we going to see a bottom here at 92.5, or are we, you know, still headed back down to 89, which looks like the previous low?
Well, on the daily charts, there are some short-term measured moves that are finishing right around this 93 level, more or less, which means that there could be some short-term stall in the selling. But the breakdown here is pretty distinct. And one of the reasons I really just wanted to capture in this chart was just to show the rise and the fall of the dollar from 2016 to 2018. And, you know, for a lot of the people that are ready to put the nails in the coffin on the dollar, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we saw a pretty significant drop in the dollar, and it didn't really change anything. And so while there's no denying that there's a very distinct downtrend on the most immediate short term, and that may very well even drop a few more handles on the downside during the selling, but I don't know whether I'm ready to write off the dollar just yet. I think that once the selling subsides, we'll see where everything calms down. But certainly this dollar selling has been the fuel that has driven a lot of the commodity bull market, and particularly the movement we're seeing in gold and silver over the last little while. So though, Eric, let's move on to chart four, where we have the crude oil chart. And really, this is where, you know, I wanted your take on this as well. Like, I was anticipating that at minimum, we should have seen some backfilling, stalling of the price action, something that bring it into the mid-30s to create a buy-on-dip opportunity. But it seems like the tight trade range we've seen in oil is almost unreal. It's almost boring to watch oil over the last little while. But, you know, it was sort of boring watching gold around 1800 until it exploded. I mean, do you think that this really has the potential for a leg higher into that fourth quarter?
Patrick, that's an excellent analogy. Just as gold surprised us by consolidating longer than we thought and then really took off. You know, what I see here, the V-shaped recovery off of the panic bottoms was very predictable, went higher than I thought, above $40. I thought we were going to get a meaningful downside retrace, let's say back down to $25 or $26. That would be about the right level to be, you know, a 50 or a 61.8% Fib retrace, and then we go up from there and see the typical kind of volatility that you'd expect. I think what's going on here is people see what Art Berman sees, and they know it's not time yet, but they know that eventually U.S. production really is going to fall off a cliff as a result of the damage that's been done to the economy, and that's going to push prices higher eventually, not yet. And I really thought we would see some downside. You know, if you look at a seasonality perspective on this, August tends to be the highest month, and it's usually right around the first week of September that the market tops out, and then it sells off through September and October, and eventually it's in the winter sometime that the price bottoms, or early winter. You know, does seasonality really even matter if seasonality is driven mostly by the consumption that occurs in summer driving season, and we haven't really had a summer driving season because of the crisis? Or maybe we're done consolidating and it's up from here. But the two potential options that I see, number one, we got the rally up to $41, $42, whatever it was, consolidate and then straight up from there. The other is a bit of a downside correction before the big move up, which might not start until the middle of Q4. It's looking more and more like this market is just looking for an excuse to move higher. So maybe we're just going to consolidate sideways until that move higher begins. I've started buying the short-term dips as opposed to waiting for a really big dip. You know, we may have to weather some volatility if I get surprised and there's a big move downside. But I was thinking before, I'm going to wait for $30 before I start buying. No, I'm not going to do that. High 30s feels like a good number to buy at this point.
Well, you know, an interesting note is that natural gas has actually broken out. And because of the steep contango in the curve, as we get into the seasonality of the winter, we're going to roll up the term structure of that contango. It's going to drive some higher prices there. But what's also interesting is that all the oil and gas stocks, the energy companies that trade on the exchanges, all of them have actually been going through quite a substantial correction over the last 2-3 months. In fact, we've seen many of them doing full 50%+ retracements of their prior rises. And so it's interesting that we didn't see the correction in oil, but we certainly have seen them in energy companies. And it would be really interesting if oil broke out, whether that proved to being a buying opportunity on many of these energy companies that have already consolidated so much. Anyway, moving on to chart five, I have here the 10-year treasury yield. And really, I don't think we have anything more to really add than what we talked about, but it's pretty interesting that the yield, and it doesn't matter that commodities are rising and even a little bit of inflation fears are popping up as a weak dollar tends to do that, but it doesn't seem to be at all a concern for the treasury bond market as the yields continue to edge lower, almost like this recession that we're in is just such a powerful deflationary impulse that maybe the bond market just doesn't believe that this is enough to drive inflation. I don't know. Do you have any other insights on that?
Well, I think we've got to put this in perspective. You don't see it on this chart, but that same approximate downslope that you see from, you know, high left to low right on this chart, that doesn't just go back the 2 years or year and a half that you've got shown in this chart. It goes back 30 years to the early 80s. You know, we're at 15 or 16% returns on on Treasury bonds. So, you know, from a big picture standpoint, you're down to 53 basis points for all intents and purposes. You've hit, you know, approximately zero. You've gone all the way from high interest rates to zero interest rate. So either that means that, okay, that's it. It's over. We got all the way to zero. You can't go any further. Or we're pausing here because people think you can't go any further. And it turns out that despite what a lot of experts have said, yes, the world's reserve currency sovereign issues really can go negative in their 10-year issue. You know, a lot of people think that's completely impossible because the U.S. dollar is the world's global reserve currency. Well, a lot of people thought it was impossible for the German Bund to go negative on the 10-year maturity. And they were right for a while until they got proven wrong, and then they got proven a lot more wrong. So are we headed to negative U.S. Treasury yields, or is there really a lower boundary at zero that has to be respected? That's the question on my mind. I already asked Jim Bianco today. I'll continue asking our other guests in future programs.
All right. So moving on to chart six, I have a chart here of Tesla. Oh, no, sorry. That's gold. But okay, so when we're looking here on gold, I mean, it's really over the last year, it appears that we're almost getting into a parabolic phase of this rise as gold is going up. And what's particularly interesting is when we look at the bear market of gold, the one that lasted from 2011 through all the way to 2000, arguably to 2016 was where the real low was. But we had this long extended basing formation on gold. And really this breakout on the upside has now, based on the measured techniques that I use, was only targeting the initial impulse up to about 2200 on the upside. So it's like we're at this stage where gold is accelerated and has broken to all-time highs and is doing so in this almost parabolic fashion. And while I remain much bigger picture bullish gold, the big question mark for me is that are we about to at least hit some intermediate high that is going to kind of pause gold? And or are we going to go into like some big extended move that could print 2,500 plus in this impulse? And it's one of the bigger pieces. But to me, this is pretty much already a very mature breakout. I'll explain it further when we get to the silver charts here in a moment. But did you have anything that you wanted to add on this gold chart before we move on?
Well, it really is an extension of the same thing that I've been saying since 1350 or so. And I know a lot of our listeners are sick of hearing me say it, but a healthy bull market is one that has its share of healthy corrections. And the reason those corrections are so important is they shake out the weak hands. We have a market now that's full of weak hands that have made a lot of money and have added to their positions higher and higher. And you end up with a situation where if the market starts going down significantly, there's a whole bunch of inexperienced investors who are going to panic and sell, and that's going to accelerate the downside. So there's a lot of risk resulting from this. I'm reminded of an interview I heard with Jim Rogers at least a decade ago. And this was the last time that gold was really taking off, you know, in the 2010-2011 timeframe. And the interviewer says to Jim Rogers, you know, and he's obviously very excited and very optimistic about gold. He said, "Jim, do you think that gold could move up even another $100 from here in the next few weeks?" And Jim said, "God, I hope not. I'd have to sell it if it did that." And that really is what comes to mind here. We're getting to a point where this is looking more and more like a blow-off top. And I know I've been saying that for a long time, and it hasn't happened. But at some point, if you get this much upside this quickly, there has to be a natural correction. So I hope that we don't get a move from here, that we're not looking at $2,300 or $2,400 gold prices in the next 2 or 3 weeks, because that's a almost sure sign of a blow-off top. What I'd much rather see is a consolidation or a correction back down to 1,800, retesting the previous breakout zone as support, and then moving higher. That's what a bull market that's healthy looks like. What we're seeing here are more and more signs of a blow-off top setting up.
Right. And so what I want to do, though, is actually overlay that or show how the chart on silver looks. And during that same cycle that we just showed on gold, where the original silver bull market, from at least on this chart, advanced in 2009 through 2011, that kind of blow off on the parabolic rise of silver. And that period from 2015 through to 2020, where silver just traded sideways in almost a purgatory for 5 years before we just broke out over the last month or more. And this seems like a very early stage breakout, which is that like it's just begun. And yet on gold, we're talking about that it seems like it's almost blowing off. And which one is going to prevail? And I wanted to use this opportunity to kind of reflect on the last major extended bull market of silver. And so on page 8, I wanted to capture that entire 2000 to 2011 bull advance in silver, where we went, you know, from $4 or $5 to $50, 1,000% rise over a decade, which was a very healthy time to have owned silver and just buying and holding it throughout that entire period. What looks like a chart, at least at first glance, that kind of starts on the bottom left and ends on the top right, I circled here a number of these advances in silver, particularly 2004, 2006, and 2008 advances, that I wanted to zoom in and really demonstrate the behavior you just described, which is you were saying earlier that, you know, what's healthy in a bull market is that the rise is checked and that there's these kind of pullbacks along the way. And so looking on page 9 was the first and legitimate breakout of silver in 2004. Now, prior in 2001 through 2003, gold was already rallying those 3 years and advancing. And very similar to what we witnessed in the last few years, silver just didn't participate. Silver was just dogging it in a sideways range. And then in mid-2003, we saw the breakout in silver in what was a very distinct, almost parabolic rise, very much echoing the type of advance we've seen today, that saw silver pretty much run almost double. It basically went from like $4 to $8. And in the process of doubling, everyone was so sure that that was a great bull market, and it was, but it didn't stop in 2004 from that blow off top, seeing it give back 30% of that entire rise. And we saw it pull back from $8 back down toward $5.50. And this is, I think, a very good example of what we may very well experience, particularly in silver, which is incredibly volatile. It doesn't mean that the gold and silver bulls that say over the next decade, the MMT and all the policies and all the debt and everything will cause inflation and gold and silver will continue to rise over the next decade. I'll agree with that. But the thing is that that didn't change the fact that there's going to be these corrections along the way. And I think that this is a very good example of what could potentially happen.
Well, Patrick, I couldn't agree more. And I think the big challenge we have, as you say, is the fundamentals are so good, so incredibly good, because it's so clear to so many people that we're headed toward a major debasement of fiat currency around the world. The fundamentals are so good for gold that it just can't seem to stop. And the problem anytime that happens is the more it goes up quickly without any significant consolidation or corrections, the more that you get weak hands into the market that are eventually going to be the source of panic selling when things do turn around for whatever reason. So I really hope that we get a 30% correction in gold. We're overdue for one, and that would really make me a lot more comfortable about buying more of it. I couldn't be more excited about the long-term fundamentals, but just, you know, look at how far we've moved, how quickly here.
So, Eric, what I wanted to then do is just continue on and demonstrate the same characteristic over again on pages 10 and 11. And so while, again, that bull market, decade-long bull market was well underway, that saw a 1,000% rise in silver over that decade, back in 2005 through 2006, silver did the same thing. It began around $6, $7 and proceeded to double, going up toward $14 an ounce in a again, another parabolic rise that followed just a few years after that 2004 rise. And again, the same pattern happened. It blew off a top and dropped 30%. And then when we look on page 11, this time it did again a similar scenario where in 2007 into 2008, we saw it almost double, going from $11 to $21 in a span of just about a half a year to create that top that occurred in early 2008. And this time the correction was much deeper, probably exacerbated by the financial crisis and the liquidity event that caused probably the correction to be much deeper than it probably should have been. But there, silver dropped 50% of its value. It went from 20 back down to just under 10. And that ended up being also a compelling buying opportunity. But very similar, just echoing exactly what we've been talking about, that this bull market probably will last a decade or more into the future. But along the way, there are these corrections. And whenever we get to these short-term periods where the impulse higher is going parabolic this way, it is often that these types of mean reverting corrections happen. And this is where, you know, our listeners need to kind of taper their short-term enthusiasm on how much more there is on the upside. It doesn't, to me, feel very asymmetric at this moment to be going into new positioning on gold and silver. And in fact, this is a stage where one of my favorite option strategies of collaring in on gold and silver becomes one of the most important tools in a toolbox on how to manage this. Because one of the biggest advantages in gold and silver is that they don't have a fat left tail skew on their options chains. And so it's really easy to build these amazing option collars on gold and silver and continue to have further upside on them, and yet locking in the gains as you're going, allow you the conviction to stay with your positions, but yet at the same time know that you're not going to give back a chunk of your profits by holding too long. And so that's a very healthy alternative to the idea of selling your long-term holdings in gold and silver. And that's currently what we're doing with our members at Big Picture Trading.
Patrick, the collar strategy is a really powerful one, but I think there's another side of this we need to talk about. It. We don't have time this week, so maybe we can come back to it in next week's post-game segment. And that is for people who just, you know, can't bear to not get involved here. Maybe they didn't have enough gold, or they didn't have any gold, and they feel like they've missed out and they want to get in on this market. I think there's probably a strong argument for using an options-based strategy, at least initially, because as you say, there is all of that significant downside. If you buy calls on gold here, you participate in the upside, but you can't lose any more than you spent on the calls. And boy, we've come up an awful long way, awful quickly. I'd also like to talk to you about some other aspects of this in terms of how much gold is too much gold. Should we think about gold as a currency, or should we think of it as a speculative investment and so forth? Let's come back to that in next week's postgame segment. Meanwhile, folks, if you want to see Patrick actually putting on these collar trades on gold and silver, just go to bigpicturetrading.com, check the information on page 12, sign up for your free 14-day trial of Big Picture Trading, and you're going to have any gold and silver collar trades coming up in the next 14 days, Patrick?
Oh, absolutely. We're already positioning. We've been long gold and silver the entire ride up, and our priority here is how to keep the gains we've made, and that's going to be what we're going to be covering in the next couple weeks for sure.
So keep the opportunity to participate in more upside while still locking in the gains that you've already got. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in this post game. There's also a link to Blaine's morning porridge titled The Gathering Wave, and a link to the Felder Report article, Generational Opportunity in Commodities. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.